Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Religions for Peace. Leaders of the world's great faiths meet in Assisi to pray and work for understanding, reconciliation, and mutual respect. We'll have a report from Assisi, and we speak to one Anglican bishop who explains the interfaith challenges facing Europe in the post-9/11 world, how his community plans to meet them. Ticking time bomb, the burgeoning humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where one UN official says the situation risks becoming an enormous social explosion. Hello, everyone. I'm Tracy McClure, and those are a look at the top stories we'll be exploring on today's program. Thanks for being with me. Leaders of the world's great religions met for a second day Tuesday in the Italian hill town of Assisi. Some 200 faith leaders, politicians, academics, and journalists have been discussing ways to promote greater understanding and reconciliation between cultures and different religious traditions. The two-day conference, first organized 20 years ago by Pope John Paul II and the Rome-based lay community St. Egidio, has become a yearly event, hailed by many as an increasingly relevant response to heightened tensions between faith communities over fanaticism and global terrorism. In an 8-page message read out to participants at the opening of the conference Monday, Pope Benedict said religion should never be used as a justification for war, and he appealed to religious leaders to use their faiths to encourage peace. A series of panel discussions was arranged to discuss issues like these. Emer McCarthy is in Assisi and filed this report.
The meeting opened Monday morning with a message from Pope Benedict XVI, a message of encouragement calling for a renewal of dialogue and an end to the misuse of religious ideologies to promote sectarianism and war. A message that also emphasized prayer, dialogue, and education in the eradication of extremism, and at the other end of the scale, indifference. Monday afternoon, the panels took a closer look at the role of the family in religious education, at religious tolerance in Africa, at the plight of Lebanon's people. These discussions were chaired by figures such as Orthodox Metropolitan Bishop Emmanuel from the Ecumenical Patriarchate, who highlighted ideologies which unite all great religions: the need to protect human life from birth to its natural end, to promote and safeguard the family as the hearth and home of religious education. Without education, ignorance can lead to indifference. Monday, the challenge of secular humanism was also tackled, a new addition to the roundtable discussions, a prominent theme in the teachings of Benedict XVI. Speaking before talks commenced, Anglican Bishop Richard Chartres of London explained to me how the new trend to identity shop often leads to the birth of religious extremism.
Of course, as the 21st century has unfolded, there has in many ways been a retreat into ghettos. There has been a great deal of anxiety about identity in the West. There's been a considerable insecurity which arises from and is associated with identity shopping. And there is, throughout much of the rest of the world, a reaffirmation on identities in which religions are often co-opted and used. And so we have a situation where, for good and for ill, religious convictions and institutions are unignorable in the public arena, as certainly in the UK they weren't only a very short time ago. There is alarm and anxiety.
Indeed, Pope Benedict XVI also said that we now live in a pluricultural, multi-religious society, where if we do want to stop the promulgation of ghettoization, sectarianism, then we really do have to look towards the future generations, into educating them in their own religious identities and also in their knowledge of other religions.
It's a difficult matter, although obviously very desirable, to combine a deep formation in one's own tradition and an embrace of other traditions, but I think it is absolutely essential to hold them both together. Because the problem very much arises from those who are insecure in their identities, and they very often grasp at decontextualized, uncharitable, sectarian versions of their tradition. I had a gathering of Muslim leaders from the UK in my house a month or so ago, and they laid out a very fascinating profile of their community in terms of the experience of four generations. For us, most of the Muslims, of course, are new arrivals from other parts of the world, notably the Indian subcontinent. And the Muslim leaders were saying, well, if you're looking at our last four generations as a community, grandma, well, she'd moved to Europe, but mentally she was still where she was brought up and born, and she was still totally immersed in the old culture. Her daughter was still attached to the faith and still praying, but more and more distant from the reality of the home country. Her daughter, the grandchild, didn't pray at all. She'd given it all up. It wasn't very useful. It didn't help to for her to make her way in the new society. Her daughter, without a direct link with the tradition, her daughter has got religion again, but in a decontextualized, hot and strong form, which doesn't actually include the wisdom, the accommodations that come from really living with the narrative over many generations. And so we have this extraordinary phenomenon in Europe of people who aren't poor, aren't marginalized, but are involved in what is very characteristic of Western society, identity shopping, where they have bought a version of their own historic religion, which is red in tooth and claw and very adversarial and very sectarian. Now, to have turned them on to that has taken our analysis, and I founded and run a centre in London in which Muslims and Jews and people of other faiths are very deeply involved, and we have a good deal of work among young people, particularly young students. And the experience is, of course, that people are turned into these lethal, decontextualized versions of faith after having been groomed and accompanied in gyms, in schools, in universities for quite a long time. So when we are talking about education, this is not a light matter indeed, as I'm sure the Pope knows that it's not a light matter. It is incredibly difficult to hold together, particularly in deracinated places where there is a great deal of identity uncertainty and identity shopping. It is very difficult to hold together a generous appreciation and a profound formation in one's own faith and an embrace of the other. We're going to have great patience. We're going to have the equal energy of those who have in gyms and clubs and universities turned this rather unrooted, restless generation to a lethal version, a decontextualized version of the historic faith. So it is essential to hold these two things together, but nobody should be under any misapprehension of the difficulties of doing so at the present moment in contemporary Europe. So we've been pursuing a very different strategy, a project which we call scriptural reasoning. And this is something which has its origins in a university setting, but we've adapted it for use among networks of young people, particularly Jews, Christians and Muslims. The Abrahamic faith is where we've started in London. And what we do is we set the horizon by reference to some of the questions and challenges which confront us all, notably things like how are we to live together without slaughtering one another, what is our responsibility to the earth. And instead of engaging in polemics and argument, we go to our own scriptures, to Torah, to Quran, to the Holy Bible, And we look for the resources in those scriptures which have some bearing on the general challenge. But we do it together in the same place. I've actually established a great tent in which we all sit on the floor in the City of London in a circle, and we actually derive from our own religious traditions some response to these common challenges. And I can only tell you the experience is this. The experience is, and these are, I'm determined to make a place where hardline people can come, because of the gathering together of clubbable persons, there is no end and no point, really. We're all very nice people. Chief Rabbi and I, and the Cardinal in London, we're not about to break the shop up. We're not the problem. We must find methods and ways of actually building new networks among a different generation of people who don't know one another and who need to be brought within a very fertile but challenging spiritual atmosphere. And I can only say the result of scriptural reasoning, which is what we call our process, the result is profounder conviction in your own tradition. But because we do it in company and accountably to one another, we're not arguing, but we are speaking in the presence of one another. It is an experience which deepens respect for other traditions as well. So as a matter of fact, we are trying to find ways and means in which we can, with integrity, pursue this kind of spiritual exploration, confronting common problems, because quite frankly, let's face it, our traditions have not had to deal with a wired-up world in which human beings have the capacity to end all human life on this planet because we have unimaginable power that we've unlocked. We have never confronted a situation where there is such ecological challenge to the whole globe. We've, of course, always had violence in parts, ecological challenge in little bits and pieces, but we're facing unprecedented challenges about which our traditions may not have thought very profoundly over the centuries. So there are new and fresh things to be brought out of our spiritual traditions if we're honestly confronting some of the common challenges of contemporary life.
One of the new additions to the panel discussions for this year's edition of the World Religion of Meetings is secular humanism. Why do you think this is an urgent issue that must be confronted not only by the Christian world, but also, as it seems, increasingly also by other religions?
Well, in Western Europe, of course, for a very long time, the religious tradition was so unthreatening, particularly in a place like the UK, you didn't really have to worry. It was another cup of tea, vicar. So, why be hostile? And let's be a bit relaxed about it. But, of course, now there's huge anxiety that religion could be a deeply destabilising and destructive force. And you've got two choices, haven't you? You either appeal to the best in faith traditions, or you say, let's take the French way out. Let's banish all religion to the margins of life. Let's get it out of the public arena altogether. Let's make sure that all churches are excluded from schools, which is one of the major issues which confronts us. So you've got a choice. And I think that secular militancy may be expected to rise with the anxiety about the renewed power and salience of religious convictions and religious institutions. And we have this crossroads where we either go deep, appeal to the resources that there are in faith traditions to be transformative and to be part of the solution, or we stop with a real worry that religions can be part of the destructive problem which afflicts our society and attempt to get them out of the public square. I think that's an incredibly short-sighted and shallow analysis of the situation, but I expect it is one that will grow in stridency in the coming years.
And how do we combat this?
Well, I suppose we have to be and appear more Christ-like.
Easier said than done.
Well, yes. There are no deft, quick fixes or technological answers to these spiritual questions. That's what makes it so difficult. You've got to live it and be it.
And that was Anglican Bishop Richard Chartres of London. He was speaking there to my colleague, Emer McCarthy, in Assisi. Well, for more on the World Meeting of Religions in Assisi, you can check out our website news. Just click on VaticanRadio.org. While the humanitarian and social challenges facing Lebanon continue to worry the church, politicians, and aid workers, the burgeoning humanitarian crisis in the Palestinian territories, especially in the Gaza Strip, is also not to be ignored. With Israeli forces continuing their military offensive against targets in Gaza, UN officials have warned that the Gazan economy is collapsing, and people there have lost almost all hope for a better tomorrow. Susie Hodges has been finding out more about the worsening plight of the inhabitants of Gaza, a place that has been called the largest open-air prison in the world. معونتي من عند الرب صانع السماء والأرض.
A ticking time bomb that risks an enormous social explosion. That's how a leading UN official described the situation in the Gaza Strip, which is home to 1.4 million Palestinians. Gaza was already struggling with an economic crisis resulting from the cut-off in direct aid to the Palestinian government by some world powers after the election of Hamas. Conditions then worsened after Israel launched a large-scale military offensive in Gaza at the end of June that inflicted major damage on the territory's infrastructure. And that sense of anger, frustration and despair felt by the inhabitants of Gaza nowadays was echoed only too clearly when I spoke to Father Manuel Musallam, parish priest and director of a Catholic school in Gaza.
Gaza is under fear. Gaza is under war. Gaza is suffering. Gaza is a sick person because all the people in Gaza is struggling to survive. The situation became so dangerous, so cruel in Gaza that the people cannot support more. This people is always humiliated because he hasn't money, he hasn't work, he hasn't freedom. This is the feeling of the people in Gaza.
Owen Murray works for the Catholic aid organization Trocare. He lived in the Gaza Strip for 2 years and has just returned from a fresh visit to the territory.
For me, one of the things that distinguishes Gaza in terms of the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem is that you get a different kind of person, and it's very much the spirit of Palestine, and you get people, the leaders of the political factions, the leaders of the military factions, the leaders of NGO and civil societies, they tend to come from the Gaza Strip, and it's a place with a lot of spirit, and in my experience, that spirit has always been strong and people look after each other. But in this most recent visit, I have to say that I found people really to be broken. Friends of mine, you could see that every single one of them really was feeling the squeeze of the economic stranglehold that's been imposed on the Gaza Strip. And I'm not sure how long people can survive like that. Of course, people are used to living on the edge, but you know, you can only push so far and eventually people will go over the edge.
Murray believes the current humanitarian situation in Gaza is the worst ever and is still going downhill. He says the recent war in Lebanon led the international community to overlook the ongoing crisis in Gaza.
Well, of course, the Israeli occupation of Lebanon and the campaign there and the attacks on civilians by both Hezbollah and Israeli certainly focused the attention of the world and marginalised the issue of what's been going on in the Gaza Strip. I mean, people in Gaza and in Palestine in general have always felt isolated and forgotten about. They've always looked at Israel as a state that behaves without regard for international law, for the Fourth Geneva Convention, for human rights law, and said, why is Israel treated differently to everyone else in the world? Why are we the ones who are always forgotten about? So I think, of course, naturally they feel isolated and they feel forgotten about, but that's not anything new for them.
The economic sanctions imposed against the Hamas-led government have led to a situation where many of Gaza's people who work for the government are no longer receiving their salaries. Murray says this cut-off in wages is having a severe impact on families, and especially the most needy and vulnerable members of society.
Since the sanctions on the Hamas government were imposed, income, if you're working for the Palestinian Authority, has dropped to virtually nothing. In the last 6 months, employees of the security services in the Gaza Strip, the West and the West Bank, have received 2 half-months' worth of pay for 6 months. And there isn't really any prospect of more money coming in over the coming months to even give them that amount. So for people like that, it's almost entirely been eliminated.
And how badly is this impacting on families and the most vulnerable members of society, like children and the elderly?
Well, of course, those people were often funding and paying for not just their own family, but also their extended family, because in the Gaza Strip, the unemployment rate was, before this situation broke out, unemployment was as high as 60-70%, depending on which part of Gaza you go to. So already people were helping out their relations, their extended family, to survive. So now it's really affecting those people who had a job and also those people who had no jobs previously. So for children, the elderly, the disabled, anyone in those categories, things have got very, very difficult. People can't get medicine. For example, diabetics can't get certain type of medicine in. Children are increasingly suffering from things like diarrhea because of the lack of clean water. And so the most vulnerable people, as always in a situation like this, are the first to be affected.
This financial crisis also means that many parents in Gaza can no longer afford to send their children to school, as Father Manuel explains.
More than 200 students from 600 left the school because they are unable to pay their fees. They are unable to pay even half of their fees. And how we can support them? We have teachers. We have many, many expenses in the school. We cannot pay that. So more than 200 people left the school. And I know that more than one family tried even to sell their jewelry to pay the school. Many women used to come to school, and they begin to weep, asking for a charity to help them for the fees, to keep the children in the school. It's a big moment of suffering. It is a time of crucifixion for a priest, because he cannot help. We gave already everything we have.
Electricity and water supplies in Gaza have also been severely affected by the Israeli military offensive and ongoing blockade.
We haven't electricity. Families are living without electricity, and they receive 2 hours, 3 hours a day, and this electricity can come by night, in the early morning, in the afternoon. It is not a regular electricity. With the lack of electricity, we have a lack of water. In the beginning of the school year, I received 700 students, and we remained 4 days without water. And you can imagine a school, 700 students without water, to be punished like this, in this manner.
Father Manuel says the Israeli blockade around Gaza and the ongoing military strikes on a near daily basis have heightened resentment against Israel among the Gazan population.
They kill more than 6-7 persons. The army is treating us like animals. Always they are punishing innocents with others. Each one, everyone, the priests, the sisters, everyone is threatened. No one is exempted, as if we are all terrorists. No, we are not terrorists.
But although the people of Gaza feel they are being collectively punished by the Israeli occupation, Murray says the Palestinians too need to re-examine their behaviour and address the near anarchy that now reigns in some parts of the territory.
since the death of Yasser Arafat, and even slightly before that, you had a breakdown of law and order inside the Gaza Strip, and you have people who are really taking their power from the barrel of a gun. So you have a spate of kidnappings, for example. And it's often, in the majority of cases, it's because the people who kidnapped the internationals, but also a large number of Palestinians are getting kidnapped, want jobs, want food, want money, or want access to power. So it's becoming politicized, and people have small arms and they have bullets, and unfortunately they're not afraid to use them. And recently, of all people to say, the spokesperson for the Hamas government, Ghazi Hamad, came out and said that it's about time that Palestinian society, particularly in Gaza, where he's based, decided to clean itself up and to reimpose law and order. And there are major political tensions which are preventing that from happening, unfortunately.
Almost 20% of the population in Gaza has long depended on food handouts from the UN and other international donors. But Father Manuel says the spectre of hunger is now spreading throughout the Gaza Strip.
I think that more than 70% of the population of Gaza haven't work and enough food to eat. And in my school, from this 700 students I have, more than 45% of them are without enough food. They have a small piece of bread. With water, they eat it.
The people of Gaza have long been known for their courage and resilience. But Father Manuel says the events of this year are exacting a heavy psychological toll.
All of them are stressed. When you walk by the road, you find people crying. All the people is crying.
Murray, too, says he was struck by the mood of desperation among the inhabitants.
I think people are largely without hope. And that's something that I'd never experienced myself before. When you meet people who feel that they have nothing to look forward to, nothing positive in the future, and no light at the end of the tunnel, psychologically for them and also for me, that's quite a difficult thing to confront. People don't really know what situation is going to be in the next week or month, let alone in the next couple of years' time. One friend of mine predicted that the next step that the Israeli occupation would take would be to put a roof on top of the Gaza Strip, because, of course, they already control the land and the sea. The next thing would be just to close it off, seal it off completely with the roof, like it was a pot that you were cooking in. And unfortunately, that kind of approach where people are sealed into what some NGOs have called the largest prison in the world means that people's anger and frustration just is exasperated. And when you have angry, frustrated people, it means that you sow the seed of conflict for years to come.
So to sum up, what were your feelings as you went around the Gaza Strip and you talked to the people? What kind of feelings did you come away with?
Very, very deeply depressed. I lived in Gaza for 2 years and built a lot of good friendships. And through the highs and lows of the Intifada, and even during the worst incursions of the Intifada, I never quite saw people in this kind of situation. And so it really left me frustrated, disappointed, and angry, but with a real feeling that governments, churches, civil society really need to take action.
So, as we've heard, the future looks bleak for the inhabitants of Gaza. But Father Manuel maintains that peace is always possible and hope should never die.
Our future is darkness now. But as Christians, we cannot give up. We keep hope.
That was Father Manuel Musalem, a parish priest from Gaza, and you also heard the voice of Owen Murray from the Irish Catholic aid organisation Trocair. And I'm Susie Hodges.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.